From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. A desperate plea from the Director General of the World Health Organization today.
Make no mistake, the greatest threat we face now is not the virus itself. Rather, it's the lack of leadership and solidarity at the global and national levels.
That warning was seemingly directed at the United States after President Trump's announcement this week that he's officially withdrawing from the organization. He did that even as the U.S. sets new records. Yesterday, 60,000 new COVID-19 cases were reported in the U.S., its sixth daily record in 10 days.
And when you compare that to other countries, Italy had 214 new cases yesterday, Mexico about 7,000, Pakistan 3,300, Japan, 197. Now, one of the states in this country that is especially concerning is Louisiana, where COVID-19 cases seem to be under control. Back in May, on the 10th of May, there were only 110 new cases reported. But since July 1st, Louisiana's daily new cases have numbered between 1,800 and 2,000. Let's turn to Dr. Suzanne Strafe-Bourgeois, who is a professor of epidemiology at Louisiana State University. Professor, why do you think this new spike is occurring in Louisiana?
So what we have seen in Louisiana is that it all started in New Orleans and then it spreads very slowly through the different parts of Louisiana. And what we're now actually seeing is a second peak. I think the reason is we started mid of May to reopen to phase two. We opened more businesses, movie theaters, casinos, and then little by little, we saw the number of cases going up again.
But you think that the initial spike that was centered more on cities like New Orleans, that there was just a low level of infection that remained, and then when other parts of the state started to open up, that the infections came from New Orleans?
It could have come from any parts, could have come from Texas or Florida, because when we entered in phase two, you know, people they're more likely to travel, to go to places and other things.
But in the first spike, you also had a total lockdown, as
yeah,
many places
did. Yeah, that's correct,
did.
Yeah.
And now you don't.
Then it went down. Exactly. So it worked.
So what do you do now about the spikes you're seeing today?
So one of the important is really to make sure that people keep their social distancing. The mask is very important, because we see more and more outbreaks occurring in, you know, wedding parties, especially bars is a concern, restaurants and other ones. We still believe if everyone would wear a mask, that actually would prevent the transmission.
Is there a lesson, do you think, for other states where numbers are currently relatively low, like New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, where cases seem like they're well contained at the moment?
Well, I think just to keep your guard up, don't think it's over at that point. Make sure that people still comply to social distancing, wearing masks, and washing their hands.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things. Late yesterday, the World Health Organization expanded its coronavirus guidance to include airborne transmission, saying the virus can be spread by tiny droplets in the air, which would explain some outbreaks in restaurants, nightclubs, places where people are singing. Is this something new or did we already know this?
So we didn't know it for COVID-19, but there was really mounting evidence that it's not only droplet transmission, which are the bigger droplets. And therefore, we really said, you know, if you keep 6 feet apart, these droplets would fall on the ground and therefore you could not infect anyone. But what there seems to be more evidence is that there is the possibility, as you said, these tiny, tiny droplets stay in the air much longer. And that's the problem, especially in very congregate settings like bars, very crowded. And then you put on top of it a very poor ventilation, and then you have the potential that you can infect people.
Dr. Strafe-Bourgeois, I just want to bring you back to sort of where we started with this, which is when you look at the cases in the United States setting records, you know, tens of thousands of people every day, and then you look at a place like Italy, which had such a terrible outbreak early on and just had 214 new cases yesterday. When are we going to be able to get to that point where we've really got the virus under control, in your view?
So my concern is that it might take us quite a while. We have a couple of other issues going on. We have testing delays that people actually don't get their test results in time enough to actually self-isolate. The other big problem is, and I've just read a study which was conducted in Spain, which goes back to the herd immunity. We always talked about that we need a herd immunity about 60 to 70%. But even like in hotspots, it seems like people have a very low prevalence of this antibody. So we might never make the herd immunity without having a vaccine. So I really think the important is that people are aware of that. Don't go to parties, don't congregate, and just think about July 4th. We still don't see what kind of impact that has on our number of cases. So I'm very concerned about that.
That is Dr. Suzanne Strafe-Bourgeois, who is a professor of epidemiology at Louisiana State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
When world leaders met to combat climate change in Paris back in 2015, they agreed to cap global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels to avoid the disastrous effects of a hotter planet. Well, now, the United Nations says we may cross that threshold in the next 5 years. Let's bring in Kim Cobb, climate scientist and professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Kim, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday's forecast is from the UN's World Meteorological Organization, and it says there's a 20% chance that we'll see a temperature increase of at least 1.5 degrees Celsius in one of the next 5 years. How significant is that information?
Well, it's very significant, of course, and this is just part of growing warming that has been occurring, you know, for decades now, and there's no reason for us to expect it to stop. But of course, that 1.5 degrees Celsius marker is a line that was drawn in the sand at the United Nations level in 2015, marking what was plausible at the time in avoiding future warming rates, but also noting that beyond 1.5, we're embracing a fairly large pile of risk, some of which we don't understand very well. So kind of bumping up against that threshold is really alarming. And of course, we expect to cross that in the very near future.
What do you mean by large risk that we don't understand well?
Well, we know that continued warming will bring some certainties to us. Rising seas, drier regions like California getting drier, more wildfire prone, and some of those wetter areas being more susceptible to extreme precipitation, none of which is welcome. But some of the most scary kind of impacts longer term have to do with potential accelerations in the kind of climate impacts that we could be bringing to our doorstep, things that are kind of the surprises we might see, including real acceleration in the system that we, of course, would be unprepared for.
1.5 degrees Celsius was the threshold, as we said, that Paris set in 2015. Does this data suggest that the pact just isn't working?
Well, obviously, we are letting 1.5 degrees Celsius slip through our fingers, despite the fact that as part of the 1.5 degree target, there was an entire report that provides a roadmap to bring that into reality. Fantastic detail. And also outlining what's at risk if we set a new target for 2 degrees, let's say, the next kind of round number, if you will, beyond 1.5. And that is what is most alarming is from a scientific perspective. We have the data, we have the knowledge, and yes, we have not acted upon it.
So what would we have to do in order to make sure that it doesn't slip through our fingers any further?
Well, we still have time. And I think that's the most important thing for people to understand about these kinds of scary reports that come out. And unfortunately, it's just one scary report after another. We still have time. And what we have to do is get to net zero emissions by 2050. And we still have a couple decades to figure that out, but we have to get going on that pathway because it is quite a tall order. We need to grow the carbon sinks on our planet, stop deforesting the tropics, and start moving in earnest to a low-carbon energy infrastructure.
There's another crisis that we're in the middle of now, and it's acute. It is the COVID-19 pandemic that's racing across the globe. Do you see any parallels between the reluctance in this country to sacrifice economically to slow the pandemic down and our apparent reluctance to make the changes that fighting climate change would require?
Well, unfortunately, the parallels for me are very stark. Climate science has been watching this train wreck happen for several decades now, and this pandemic train wreck is very similar. You're sacrificing what you think is public health and well-being for short-term economic gain, but what you are really doing is baking in long-term economic damage. And that is exactly what's happening with climate change. People are looking down the road at their next election or, you know, their next quarterly report. And we are basically piling on a huge tab. It's growing by the year, called climate change impacts that will have long-term and sustained damage to our economy. The pandemic, of course, will have its own impacts economically for quite some time. And there's no real escaping that. But with climate change, if we move purposefully in a data-driven fashion, we can actually have progress while growing our economy. And there are many different policy instruments to reach for to let that happen.
Kim Cobb is a professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump today repeated his threat to withhold federal education funding if schools remain closed at the start of the coming school year, tweeting, "Schools must be open in the fall." Meanwhile, teachers and administrators are planning for how to start the school year as the nation breaks records for new daily cases of coronavirus. For more, we're joined now by Arne Duncan, former Secretary of Education under President Obama. Welcome back.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you've said it is too early to tell if schools should reopen in the fall where you are in Chicago. Do you disagree generally with President Trump that schools should reopen in the fall, or just how he's trying to force them to do so by threatening to withhold federal funding if they don't?
Well, we all want schools to reopen. As a parent, I want that. Our kids want it. Our teachers want to go back to school. The question for the country is it safe for them to do so? And, you know, Trump trying to bully people, trying to threaten. He has no, you know, authority here. He can't withhold funds. It's a lot of continued, you know, bluff and bluster and dishonesty. And what we obviously need to do to make our schools safe is to make our communities safer. And it's actually his tremendous lack of leadership, just horrific leadership over the past several months. That's the only reason why whether or not we can go back to school safe in the fall is in question now. Had we done as a country what we needed to do earlier, testing, tracing, you know, quarantining where we needed to, we would not be having these really, really difficult conversations now.
Well, what is the benchmark that you would look for to determine that it is safe to open schools? Is there anywhere in the country that you look at right now and say, you know, if things stay as they are right now, that place could open safely?
Yeah, no, every situation is different. And I'm, you know, to be very clear, I'm not the scientist or the epidemiologist. But what, as I talk to those guys on a fairly consistent basis, what they're saying is the biggest indicator they're looking for is places where we're seeing declining rates of COVID. And actually, as you know, right now, as we speak, we're seeing record numbers of cases every single day. Unfortunately, in the vast majority of states, record numbers of cases in those individual states. And those things are going in the wrong direction now. And, you know, what we do now in the month of July will determine whether our kids and our teachers have a chance to go back to physical schools, you know, as we go into August. So July will shape August, and that's up to all of us. We can't look for help from the federal government. It's not going to come. We can't look for, you know, honest advice. That's not going to come. We have to do it ourselves.
But even if we had a perfect July all across the country, would it really be safe to say that schools could reopen at the end of August? As we remember, you know, in the beginning of the pandemic, really in the United States in mid-March, it wasn't until late April that we started seeing deaths spike the way that they did.
Yeah, correct. And again, I think what it means to reopen is going to vary tremendously. So my short answer is I think everything will be different. Almost nothing will be the same. We might have kids on a, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule. We might have other students on a Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, possibly. We might do morning shifts. We might do afternoon shifts. You know, cafeterias, unfortunately, may be a thing of the past for a while. Choir might be a thing of the past. How we walk in hallways, how we clean bathrooms, how we ride buses. Everything's going to be different. And again, that's going to vary case by case and place by place of how we try and keep not just students safe, but obviously teachers and staff and principals and custodians and bus drivers, everybody, as well as the parents and grandparents back home. So there's a tremendous amount of thoughtfulness that superintendents are working across the country to figure out, what's the best way to try and do this. My best guess now is that we'll end up in a hybrid situation where you will have some students in physical school some of the time, but all students will be spending a significant part of time, maybe the majority of their time, virtually. And that's not ideal. I desperately wanted almost like a mandatory summer school to start this month in July to make up for the learning loss. But because of the lack of federal leadership, because of the tremendous dishonesty, because we as a country haven't done what we needed to do, we lost that opportunity to get kids back into school now and to help get them caught up. And I just desperately hope our children don't continue to lose out because of our inability to make some small sacrifices on their behalf as adults.
Well, let me just drill down with you on the idea of either a staggered schedule or a hybrid model. What does that mean for the parents if the kids have to spend, Tuesdays and Thursdays home from school?
It's a real challenge. And let me make it even more complicated for you, unfortunately, because the nuance here is extraordinarily important to try and understand. Let me give you a couple of scenarios. You may have certain teachers who, because of their own pre-existing conditions, won't be safe to teach at all in a physical building. So they'll have to do all of their teaching virtually. There may be certain students, maybe not because of their own health issues, but maybe because they're raised by their grandmother or their grandfather living with them, who they won't be able to go to school physically at all. There may be other children who will need to be in school every day because their parents are essential workers. And we're going to have to accommodate that. And so this is going to be, a school by school, grade by grade, classroom by classroom, calculation. And we're going to have to look out for each other and understand our shared humanity in ways maybe we haven't always done that. And there may be a child who would like to go to school more, but may have to go to school a little bit less because another child in his class has to be at school every day. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we'll get to that point, but I'm just trying to get people thinking about those are the kinds of real decisions that teachers and principals are going to have to make in the very near future.
Let's talk about masks, too. It's one thing to ask a class of 12-year-olds to wear their masks. It is another thing to try to require that a class of 6-year-olds wear their masks all the time and wear them in the right way and don't take them off and touch their face and then touch their friends or whatever the case might be. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, none of this is easy. And I that part actually, I think, is frankly a little bit easier. And I've seen, lots of kids now on the streets, little guys, 3, 4, 5, 6-year-olds wearing their masks. And some of them look pretty cool. And I think that's been okay. The harder part, and the part honestly breaks my heart, is that kids have a natural, they want to hug, they want to touch, they want to play, mm-hmm. they want to play tag. And, we as human beings need and desire that physical interaction. And that's a really hard thing to say, can you do none of that? How do we try and do that? How do you do PE? How do you do recess? And that is honestly really heartbreaking for me that, at least for a little while, it seems like we're going to have to try and, restrict some of that. And that's the mask part isn't easy, but I think it's doable. This other part is just such an innately human desire. It's just a really sad thing to me, but it's just unfortunately where we are as a country right now. But it's not fair, to teachers. And what I always say is that schools are not bubbles. Controlling this virus, that's going to be done not at the school level. Schools are playing an important role, but that's going to be done at the community level. And all of us, who live in communities have to be willing to do the things now in July that will put teachers and students in a better position come August. We have to wear masks. We have to stay off the beaches. We have to stay out of bars. We have to, stay away from indoor dining. And if we as adults can't make those small sacrifices to give our children amazing, learning and social opportunities going into the fall, then really shame on us. Shame on us.
A lot of school districts are looking to the CDC for guidelines about what they should do. And as you know, this week, Vice President Pence, after a lot of criticism from President Trump that the CDC guidelines were too restrictive, said, well, they're going to come out with new guidelines next week. Do you trust the CDC guidelines? Do you think that they're being politicized?
It's just so heartbreaking to me that everybody's scared of this. You know, Trump is a bully. And let me say a couple of things. You know, so one, that makes no sense. Two, he has no ability to order schools opened. Three, he has no ability to withhold funds from schools unless he does something, you know, absolutely illegally. Actually, yesterday, coincidentally, my predecessor, Secretary Spellings, who happens to be a Republican and worked for, you know, President Bush, and Tom Frieden, Dr. Tom Frieden, who ran the CDC, we put out guidance yesterday that is, you know, bipartisan, that is thoughtful, that is based on science and scientists and their best thinking, has no hint of politics or partisanship. So I would encourage districts to and school leaders to take a look at that guidance.
I want to just turn to higher education because several universities are now suing the Trump administration over its decision to revoke visas for some international students if they're not taking in-person classes. And there are many universities that are saying all the classes are going to be online this coming fall for safety. What do you think the universities should do in this situation?
Well, of course they should sue. And, you know, Trump hates immigrants until he needs them as leverage. And then somehow, you know, he acts like they're important. This is not about their learning opportunities. This is about trying to bend universities to his will. And when it is not safe to do so, when that is going to cost lives, it's unconscionable to do that. So universities, you know, have to sue. I assume they'll be successful in court. It is just, you know, infuriating that they have to go to those lengths, you know, that we're spending time on that rather than planning for actually dealing with the epidemic. You know, Trump is hoping he can just sort of tweet away the deaths, tweet away, act like everything is normal. And so it's just a catastrophic collapse of leadership at the federal level that is costing lives and, you know, hurting our kids, you know, whether it's K-12 or hurting higher education. And this play around, you know, students who live overseas, they're just the latest pawns in a very sick game that he's playing.
That is Arne Duncan, former Secretary of Education under President Obama, now managing partner for the Emerson Collective. Arne Duncan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity. Have a great day now.
For weeks, experts who predict bankruptcies have been warning that U.S. companies are veering toward a COVID-19 cliff. Well, this week, more retailers have fallen over the edge. Brooks Brothers, Sur La Table, and the Japanese retail chain Muji join the 100-plus companies that have filed for bankruptcy since the pandemic began. Mike Regan is a senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter.
Another tough week for retail. What's your takeaway?
Well, so two main things. I mean, obviously, the closure of the sort of physical brick and mortar retail stores is a major hit for companies that still rely on them more than, say, their online operation. But also, you know, while the pandemic is causing a big drop in overall consumer spending, it's also obviously causing a massive shift in how it's spent. So for, say, a company like Brooks Brothers, you know, how many office workers were inclined to, say, freshen up their business and business casual wardrobes this spring? So it's really a tough environment for that type of chain.
The list is long. Let me just tick through a few more. JCPenney, Neiman Marcus, J.Crew, Pier 1, GNC, Aldo, the parent company of Ann Taylor. A lot of these companies plan to restructure. But all told, the research group CoreSite is predicting that more than 20,000 retail stores will close this year. That is a lot of stores. First question is, where are all those workers going to go? And how is that going to change the landscape of retail down the road?
Right. Well, the big question in many economists' mind is exactly that. How many of the jobs lost during the pandemic will sort of be permanently lost, or at least lost for the next few years? You know, even if you reopen the economy, you know, if there's some miraculous cure for the virus overnight, the question is how much damage has been done to make those job losses permanent? And I've seen a variety of estimates, but it's hard to say exactly which one's right. But certainly many lost jobs will be more than, say, just a furlough or a temporary layoff. They'll be lost for a longer period of time.
A lot of those companies also have a lot of debt that's going to be restructured. What kind of strain does that put on the banking system?
So when you think of that debt, you know, it's important to remember some of it's actually held by investors in the form of corporate bonds or syndicated loans, but a lot is held by banks, so it certainly is a strain. On the good side, there's been so many regulations to sort of make banks more sturdy for this type of thing since the last crisis in 2008 that it's unlikely to cause a crisis on that scale. But I'll tell you, if you look at indexes of bank stocks in the U.S., they're all down almost 40% for the year. So that gives you an idea of how bad this is for the banking system.
Mike, I got just about 45 seconds here, but some companies are thriving. Tesla's stock is up 500% in the past year, and it is on the cusp of being added to the S&P 500.
Right. The remarkable story. And surrounding that, there's still this tremendous amount of skepticism about Tesla's stock. But in a way, that can be actually good for the stock, because if people are shorting it, they're borrowing the stock and hoping to, you know, repay the loan later with cheaper stock. That kind of forces the stock higher in what's known as a short squeeze. So that's at least part of the story of this rally, but probably not all of it.
All right. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks for your time. As always, have a good weekend.
Thanks, Peter.
The idea of government giving people cash payments every month was gaining momentum even before the pandemic hit. But now, the trend is growing faster. Last week, mayors from cities like Atlanta, Oakland, St. Paul, and others came together to form a group called Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. And yesterday, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey committed $3 million to the cause. Stockton, California Mayor Michael Tubbs is the group's founder, and he's been piloting a universal basic income program in his city since 2019. Mayor, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So more than a dozen mayors joining your effort to offer people a guaranteed income. Now this week, news of Jack Dorsey's gift. Why do you think this effort is growing?
The effort is growing because the time is demanded. We're living in an unprecedented global health crisis, the worst since 1918 in our country. We have folks taking to the streets protesting not just police violence, but I would argue the violence of racism and the violence of poverty. And it's a real New Deal moment, especially considering the fact that our biggest pandemic response thus far has been unemployment insurance, which was created in 1935. As part of the New Deal, there's an understanding that we have to update our social safety net to reflect 2020 realities.
You never could have predicted when this started in 2019 that a pandemic was going to unravel the economy, though. How has this moment that we're in changed your thinking about the whole project?
This moment has changed my thinking in seeing a guaranteed income as actually a pandemic resilience tool. That we live in a time of pandemic, so this year is COVID-19, but next year will be a fire, the year after be a flood or a hurricane, and that an income floor and guaranteed cash that people can count on allows our folks to build the economic resilience needed to persist during pandemics. And that's not something that was in my frame when we started the pilot in Stockton.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about that program. 125 people randomly selected in Stockton. They've received $500 a month. Looks like you recently extended the program until 2021. What have you learned? Have you seen that it's helping people build wealth for the long term?
Well, something as small as $500 a month is not necessarily enough to build a lot of wealth, but what we've seen it do is be enough to be a lifeline and allow people to stabilize. So there's stories of individuals like Tomas, who was able to take the $500, take time off from his old job to interview for a new job because he worked retail. And if he just took time off, he would lose money. But the $500 gave him that security to take a risk on himself. And he was able to get a better job with benefits, stable hours, and is now able to afford tutoring for his children. Or there's another young lady in the program who said the $500 allowed her to buy dentures, because she went without smiling for 2 months because she couldn't afford dentures. There's others who've talked about how they've used it to pay off debt. So we're seeing that something as small as $500 isn't enough to replace work, isn't enough to change the nature of this country. But it is enough to allow people who are working hard to contributing just a floor to stand on as they seek to build and better their lives and the lives of their communities.
How are you going to fund this on a larger scale, especially now that city and state budgets are stretched very, very thin?
Well, it would have to be a federal response. And again, I would argue we're in a New Deal moment. We just spent trillions of dollars So there's bills right now in the Senate that speak by Senator Harris and Senator Markey and Senator Sanders that speaks to a $2,000 a month for everyone during COVID-19. I think that's a great first step. There's talks now about looking at the Pentagon budget. You can legalize marijuana and use some of the taxation from that. So the issue isn't a resource issue. The issue is really one of political will and understanding that we can trust everyday folks like you and me the same way we trust billionaires and trust CEOs to make good decisions. And we've tried trickle-down economics for my entire life, for at least the past 30-plus years. It just doesn't work. It won't work. It can't work. So maybe it's time to rethink how we think about our economy and understand our economy is actually rooted in the people who drive it. And investing in them is the smartest investment we can make.
It looks like right now you've kind of depended on private philanthropy to help fund this. You're saying that you think the federal government needs to pick up the bill, but how realistic is that really? Because even though we're talking more about UBI, universal basic income, it isn't mainstream. And you have a lot of skeptics out there who say cash payments won't solve other core issues, things like addiction or poor health care. And that if you give money to everyone, what you're actually doing is taking money away from programs that help poor people. What do you say to that?
I disagree. I reject the scarcity mindset because we only seem to have that mindset when it comes to helping normal, everyday Americans. I think that we have to be additive in a country that has the resources to provide an income floor for everyone so we don't have to have poverty. I think it's immoral. So we have a lot of work to do, and a guaranteed income isn't a panacea. It's not going to solve every issue. But as Dr. King says, it does solve the cash issue that's associated with poverty or economic insecurity, and that's probably the most pressing issue during COVID-19.
Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs, also the founder of Mayors for Guaranteed Income, a group that is growing. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Northwest region of the United States has never elected an African American to the House of Representatives, but that could change this year. In Washington State, two black women are running for the open House seat being vacated by Democrat Denny Heck. David Hyde from member station KUOW in Seattle reports.
Marilyn Strickland served as mayor of Tacoma, Washington for nearly a decade. She was the first African American woman to hold that office.
This is a moment in history where we have the opportunity to make change. I will say that when I see young people, teenagers of all races and backgrounds, protesting day in and day out, talking about why these things are important, that's very hopeful.
Now, Strickland is one of two black women running in Washington's 10th congressional district south of Seattle, where about 15% of residents are people of color. She says the protests against police brutality point to deeper problems with structural racism in American society.
And I remind folks that some of the kids who are teenagers now, the only president they've known was Barack Obama when they were little. And now they have Donald Trump. And they're probably wondering to themselves, what happened?
And I said, yes, I would run. I would run realizing all of the controversies that would swirl about my head.
That's Shirley Chisholm from New York, who in 1968 became the first black woman elected to Congress. In 1972, she was the first woman, an African American, to run in a presidential primary. But Chisholm later said neither first was how she wanted to be remembered.
I want to be remembered as a catalyst for change in America.
Half a century later, the Northwest is still waiting for that change. There's never been a black member of Congress elected from the states of Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Alaska, or Oregon, for now. Christine Reeves is also running in the 10th here in Washington state. In 2016, she became the first black woman elected to the state house in nearly 20 years. Reeves says with the protests this year against racial inequity, political change is in the air.
People are tired of asking nicely for the change that we need to see in a government that should reflect all Americans. Folks are saying we're now demanding that change.
And Reeves says when it's time to write new laws, representation matters because experience matters.
Even as a candidate for the state house, I got called the N-word six blocks from my house. I had the police called on me at least six times, depending on the neighborhoods that I would doorbell in, because I wasn't their neighbor. This is a culture that needs to be overhauled in a society, quite frankly, that is using police as a weapon against its own citizens.
The race for the 10th in Washington state is getting national attention. Strickland and Reeves received a dual endorsement this year from Higher Heights for America, a nonprofit which supports black women running for office all over the U.S. Glinda Carr is the head and co-founder.
The 23 million Black women in this country are still underrepresented and underserved. But what we've seen over the last several election cycles is a steady increase in the number of Black women running and a number of Black women winning.
Carr says today Black women are around 8% of the total U.S. population, but only 4.6% of Congress. And more Black women are running and winning in places they've been shut out before. In 2018, Black women candidates won in three states for the first time, for example, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Minnesota.
And so you look at this race in Washington state with two, you know, prominent African-American women who were previously elected. They're poised, given the way, obviously, the elections happen in Washington, to potentially be, you know, the top two candidates that come out of that primary.
And Carr says more Black women are winning in districts that don't have majority-minority populations, like Washington's 10th, but adds that there's still a long way to go. Only 19 states have ever elected a Black woman to Congress. That means if Strickland or Reeves are elected, that number would move to 20, and the Northwest would have its first Black member of Congress. For Here and Now, I'm David Hyde in Seattle.
The latest Tom Hanks movie comes out today. It's called Greyhound. It's the story of a U.S. commander that defended an Atlantic convoy from U-boat attacks during World War II. The film's theatrical release was sunk by the pandemic, so Apple TV Plus picked it up. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And Tom Hanks in this film, actually, he wrote it and he stars in the film. He plays the captain of the ship, the Greyhound. Here he is leading a chase for a Nazi submarine.
Target bearing 092, range 15 miles.
Charlie, what do you make of this target?
Most likely a U-boat, sir.
Up for air and a battery charge. Getting ready to come at us, Captain.
Boy, what a surprise to hear Tom Hanks in a World War II film, Eric. Tell us more about
that
this
never
movie.
Happens. Well, this is one that he wrote himself, and supposedly he took 10 years figuring out how to do this. So people may remember or know about World War II that there were convoys of ships that were going through the Atlantic. These convoys of ships would reach a point where planes that could sink submarines had to peel off. They did not have enough fuel to make the entire trip with them. And so then they would have to count on these warships that are escorting them to try and take out any of the German U-boats that would try to sink them. So we've got one scene, for example, where, you know, Hanks sort of explains a little bit what they're doing and trying to find these U-boats. The name of his ship is Greyhound. The name of one of the British ships that he's escorting is called Harry. And they're trying to figure out why the U-boats aren't just coming out and attacking them when they know that they're in the water. Let's check out this clip.
Greyhound, Harry. 9 miles to one pip at 090. The other bearing 092, range 8 miles.
Are the ranges closing?
Negative, Greyhound. They seem to be behaving at present.
Very well. Maintain your stations. Attack within range. Good luck.
A wolf pack shadow on us. They'll attack as a group.
Yeah, waiting for nightfall. And we can't see nothing.
Yeah, so there's constantly exchanges like that where you get a sense of the strategy. And so it is a really interesting story. And I see why Tom Hanks wanted to try and make it into a movie.
And would it be interesting, do you think, for people who are not already interested in movies about World War II?
Well, here's the thing. You know, it's Tom Hanks. And so what it really is it's a showcase for Tom Hanks playing yet another in a long string of men of virtue. And I don't want to downplay that or trivialize that because, you know, he's written this script. I feel like he did a pretty good job with it. But that said, at a time like this, you know, when we're constantly going back and sort of reinterrogating all the movies and media that make us see certain people as heroes and certain people as villains, you know, it's awfully convenient that he stars in a movie that's set in World War II, where he's on the side of right, but the only two people of color that we see in the movie are the guys from the galley bringing him his dinner. So, you know, compare that to Spike Lee's The Five Bloods, where it's about five Black Vietnam vets. That's a movie that's all about confronting America's hypocrisy and all about confronting what it asks of people of color, even while it's oppressing them. And by going back to World War II, you get to skip over all of that stuff. And, you know, as much as I like to see Tom Hanks in a movie, maybe I'd like to see him try to interrogate some of that stuff sometimes.
All right, well, let's talk about the other aspect of this that's very interesting, which is that it is going straight to TV. Now, in the old days, that would have been kind of like not a great thing for a movie. But right now, that's the only choice they have, because there are really no ways to put the movies into theaters and make the money that they want. So what do you think about that? Is this going to cement a new trend of things going straight to streaming?
What I think it will do is I think that a better class of movie will be considered to make this transition from theater to television, because people will grow used to seeing this kind of material on their TV screens. You know, Disney Plus decided to abandon plans to put the Hamilton film in theaters, and they put it on Disney Plus. A lot of people watched it. I have a feeling a lot of people are going to watch Greyhound. I would bet that more people watch Greyhound on Apple TV Plus than would have watched it if it would have been in a movie theater, because frankly, I don't know that I would be willing to pay 9 or 10 or 12 bucks to watch this compartmentalized movie. But on television, it's wonderful. And I think Hollywood needs to rethink, you know, what kinds of these projects can play in people's homes and really do well. I have a feeling that even when we get to the point where movie theaters are open, there are going to be people who'd rather stay at home where they know it's safe. I have a lot of cinephile friends who look at this with horror. You know, I predicted this years ago, and I just think it's the consequence of our streaming culture, of our media culture, and it's been accelerated by this pandemic.
That is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, maybe soon NPR film critic too, because it's all going to be on TV. Eric,
well, didn't
thank
I
you.
Just review Greyhound?
Good job.
Bob Mondello, I'm gunning for your job, buddy.
Oh, we love Bob. Thank you, Eric.
We do. Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.